This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have as my guest one of the leading theologians in America today, Martin E. Marty. Martin Marty taught 35 years at the University of Chicago, mostly in the Divinity School there, which has established the Martin Marty Center. He's been working on the magazine The Christian Century for 50 years now, many years as the editor. He's the author of more than 50 books, and he's the co-editor of a crucially important series of 5 volumes on fundamentalism, a subject we'll talk more about today. Martin Marty, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Good to be here.
You know, that study of fundamentalism you helped edit and direct, that came out in the early 1990s, I was surprised to see when I checked the volumes out. That was years before 9/11, of course. Were you surprised then by the Al-Qaeda attack?
When we were finished with 6 volumes of study, 5 volumes of study, of 23 fundamentalisms, different religions, we saw everything that could lead to war, to takeovers, things like Algeria takeover, and so on, nation after nation. It was Muslim versus Muslim all the time. And the one word we didn't use was terrorism. It hadn't really come about yet. During our years, you'd had the coal thing, you'd had the Kenya, you'd had the first World Trade Center thing, but no more than did the president of the time or the president who's his successor add all these up and say, this is what's coming.
Why do you think you missed it?
I think we thought there were enough internal controls in the governments that were being besieged. Should we take Algeria for an example?
Sure.
In Algeria, the government was nominally Muslim. Everybody was in Algeria. It was corrupt to the core. It was military. It was repressive. It was incompetent. And typically, our scholar, Hugh Roberts from Wales, was the scholar on the scene, said, all the young guys are leaning against the wall. There's an Arabic word, the young men who lean against the wall. And the young women on the other side, inside the house. They're 18, 19 years old. They're entering their sexual prime. They are in a culture where adultery is death penalty, so they can have no sexual relations unless they marry. They can't marry unless they prove they have a place to live. Their 4 older brothers and sisters are already living with their parents in poverty. They can't get an apartment unless they have a job, and they know they will never get a job. Somebody comes into town and says, Allah did not intend that indignity for you. These are nominal followers of Allah, but they're corrupt, repressive, military, and incompetent. Follow me, follow us, join the movement, and we'll change that. Which they didn't do successfully, but it was the lure.
They did get popular, though.
Well, what happened was that April, well, it must be, 13, 14 years ago, there was to be an election. The polls said 56% of the people were going to follow them, so they called off the election. Well, then 90% are there. And within a few months, we're down to 1 Hilton hotel with a few diplomats, a few media people in, and that's it. It just came crumbling in. Now, as years pass, Algeria has gotten a little better. It's not a place you'd want to live, but it got a little better. A French scholar named Gilles Kepel has made a study of 10 places that were utterly hardline and then didn't come about. And I think most of our scholars, many of them were Iranian or trained in Iran, thought that the same thing would happen in Iran in that the revolution failed to deliver. The population doubled, jobs didn't, poverty grew. A new corrupt elite was running it, and then the new guy is elected because of those things, and he turns out to be regressive and retrogressive and going back to the worst. But I think we thought the process would be wearing down, exhaustion, other forces taking over, and we didn't realize that something like Al-Qaeda would be ready for no matter what level of frustration because it had an ideology.
And one, perhaps one misconception in those volumes was that the anger and the militancy of these fundamentalisms is turned more toward people who agree with them, generally share the same religion but aren't as devout or militant as they are. Whereas in this case, with Al-Qaeda, he went after the far enemy, as it was called.
That was one of the big turns along the way. Most of the others, in India, for example, it was one of these movements that killed Gandhi. In Iran, it was the Shah. It was always one of your own who was nominally of what you're supposed to be. I think the difference with bin Laden and the newer ones now, they have a concept of what my late colleague Marshall Hodgson called Islam-dom. Once it's been our territory, we will fight back forever. I think that's a big part of the roots of the Israeli thing. They had the concept in 1948, the alien came and took over something of ours, and we must someday win it back. And what has happened now with the U.S. is we are seen as the agent, the instigator, the funder, the ideologue behind all such movements. I think that's one of the reasons why, so far, at least, Malaysia and Indonesia, where the majority of the world's Muslims are, there are these movements. We've had terrorism. We've had all these deaths and so on. But it's not quite as consistently the focus that the outsider is doing it.
Are you worried that in a place like Indonesia that there may be a rise of this kind of militant fundamentalism?
I'm not only worried, I think it's happening. I think all the energies we can do to put into keeping Malaysia, Indonesia, the Muslim and Hindu parts of India open are important. When the BJP party in India was defeated a couple of years ago, mainly on economic grounds, but they were the harder line people, we cheered or should have cheered. To me, the irony always is that we cheer when a government turns secular, like Turkey or India, and then we have so many forces in the United States who say our government has to turn religious, and we don't see the irony of that.
I'm speaking with the theologian Martin Marty. This is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Christian fundamentalism here in the United States, let's be more specific, right-wing militant Christian fundamentalism, because there is liberal and left-wing fundamentalism in the United States. To what extent is that cresting in popularity, or do you think, what trajectory do you think it's on?
Well, for one thing, it is highly diverse internally. Whenever we talk about the right, they're not all political, for example. The hottest thing going now are the building of mega churches and the prosperity gospel, God wants you to be rich, which are, in a sense, diversions from the other. And the people who flock to these big churches are looking for a gospel that tells them they're in good shape with God and they'll do well in the country. I know where they're voting, but they're not the front rank of it. And there is, as your question implied, let me know that you know, that there is an evangelical left, that there are a lot of people that are taking up the environmental cause that didn't 5 years ago. So there's internal variety, and I believe very much that we shouldn't clump them all together. But the hardcore, and what's often called the base, includes fundamentalists, certain kinds of Pentecostals who aren't normally fundamentalists. They're too diverse and ecstatic. Evangelicals who were grandchildren of the hardcore fundamentalists. A lot of them will rally around certain causes. Roe v. Wade triggered one, school prayer amendment caused it another, gay marriage is another. On those causes, they form a hardcore. They can be sundered somewhat. They can be taught to stay at home. The old, it's the economy, stupid, plays a role. So all these things can play a role in it, and I'd point to their internal diversity. But the hardcore is uncompromising, intransigent. They're not terrorists. When we started our project, we had a fine historian of fundamentalism, teacher at Calvin College, Joel Carpenter, said, Marty and my associate Appleby, Marty and Appleby, you better remember there are no guns in the basement of the Moody Bible Institute. And in that sense, we have been spared.
Or guns in the basement of the Amish settlers or something. So, I'm wondering about the leadership, though, of the evangelical right. I mean, there was Jerry Falwell recently guaranteeing, by word of God, a victory for the Republicans in November. What do you make of that merging of the religious and the very partisan political?
Well, that has been, it's been the strength of the conservative Republican administration. It's also something that immobilizes them a little bit. They can't satisfy them all the time. A lot of the people over there in the religious groups really feel betrayed because the debt, the budget. I was driving along one day some years ago, and I heard James Dobson, the leader of the Focus on the Family, say, tomorrow we need 300,000 letters to Washington because the most important legislation in many, many years is up. And I thought, what's coming? It was a balanced budget amendment. And that was the big, that was a moral thing, because you could keep government small, you could keep government out of the family, and that's good. Well, you don't hear Dobson talking about balancing the budget now. They shift along the way, but the administration and the party don't dare alienate such. And I think it's a very delicate line. But for now, the line is holding pretty much.
What do you make of how we, those of us who aren't right-wing evangelicals, even those of us who are secularists or secular progressives as I am, how do we engage in conversation with people who are right-wing evangelicals? I mean, there are, I know some people that I talk to say, well, there's no conversation possible.
Well, it isn't easy. I like to quote St. Benedict at the monastery. What do you do if a cantankerous and obstinate and dogmatic person comes in and insists on his way and ruins the fellowship? And you do all the things that Benedict is supposed to do. You pray with him. Maybe he'll change and converse. Then you get him to work, clean out the cow shed, and maybe that'll work. Then you pray, that should work. Then you use reason, that should work. And the punchline, finally, is that if none of this works, and he's still, I think the word is contumacious and obstructive, then you disruptive of the fellowship. Then you get two stout monks to take him outside and explain the matter to him. Well, if the Benedictines can be that frustrated when you can't get through, we have the same thing. In this fundamentalism project that we did for 6 years, over 100 scholars, we tried to get fundamentalists among them. Everyone who wrote was at home with the tradition. The American captain was Nancy Ammerman, who was Southern Baptist. We would have the Ayatollah Abdulaziz Sachedina writing on it. You know, these were people who really knew it from within and weren't hostile, and they always tried to get one to come. The reason they never got one was this was a comparative study, and each fundamentalism thinks that it is so unique in every respect that even be in a book with somebody else is compromising. But they were often in attendance, and we stayed close to them as well as we could, and I keep friendships with some of them. But I don't think you ever break through if they are confirmed in the fact that this absolute view of the truth as they have it, not only why discuss, but if we do, we'll compromise. There's a history of fundamentalism by a scholar at Bob Jones University, a man named Dollar. History of Fundamentalism is called, written 20 years ago at least. And he said the most dangerous man in America the last half century is Billy Graham. Now, Billy Graham could sign on every doctrine of fundamentalism, but because he won't come to Milwaukee unless the Catholic archbishop's on stage and the Episcopal and so on, and he wrote a letter to the rabbis of New York, I'm coming to New York, and evangelists like to have people get converted, but I'm not going to target Jews. That's giving the game away. So I don't see much hope, but I think hospitality, keeping the invitation out, engaging on whatever level you can, one does.
Martin Marty, what percentage of the American population is a right-wing fundamentalist, or what percentage thinks, for instance, that Bush is there by God as president?
The last part I don't have any complete data on. That varies from month to month. If they don't like him, then they're not so sure God was on his side. The most recent data we have as of really September of 2006, one of the more extensive surveys taken, you could say 33% of Americans are self-identified as evangelical. But that includes open-minded evangelicals. It includes Pentecostals.
And the black churches.
A lot of the people in the black church and so on, Southern Baptists, et cetera. This is not a nation in which it's easy to be a hardcore fundamentalist. The lures are all over the place. Your kid goes to college and gets drawn into something more attractive. There are a lot of places to go. But I'm sure that 40% of the American people with a hardcore base think that God and the president have a special relationship that they should be responsive to.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Martin Marty, one of the leading theologians in America, who was co-editor of an incredible series back in the 90s on fundamentalism. He's been associated with the Christian Century, the magazine, for 50 years now. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine. Tell me what your reaction was to President Bush's term Islamofascism.
A very negative reaction, and I wrote about it instantly, and I think that the fact that so many of us from so many different political and religious viewpoints countered it, that the administration has backed off. They've been looking for a term all the time. And most of the terms they chose were, I think, well-intended. They left a certain opening. You have to call things something or other. And they did. But I think it's an attempt to lump them all together. And they took the riskiest of historical analogies. Once you say Nazi or fascist or something like that, you've closed off the discussion. You don't have anything more to say. There are parallels, but putting the adjective that way made it sound too as if you're Muslim, you have a tendency toward this. And the vast majority of Muslims of the world never did. A vast majority of them still don't. In America, I think there was just outrage among all of them to have. You're really saying you're using your religion to be a new Hitler, a new Mussolini, a new Hirohito or something like that. And it didn't work. And I just was reading somewhere the other day to see how suddenly it came and went. It has not stopped on right-wing radio. There's cultural lag there, and it'll go on as long as they have backing for it. But again and again, the administration, in a sense, takes lessons. The day after 9/11, the president said, we're going to start a new crusade. The next day, I have a picture of the imam and Professor Aziz Al-Hibri, one of our scholars, in a mosque on Massachusetts Avenue, and there's the president. Well, she's the kind of person who can just go up to the president and say, you will never use that word again, and he never did. I mean, it just stopped. So I think that was true with Islamofascism. Right-wing radio and magazine commentators invented it, and somebody picked it up quickly. I do think his former speechwriter, who was a moderate evangelical,
Michael Gerson,
Wheaton College grad, would have been more sensitive and alert and sophisticated.
A beautiful writer, by the way.
Oh, very good writer. Oh, my speeches, if there's a good phrase coming out, we know where they came from.
Some of Bush's rhetoric dovetails with the rhetoric of militant fundamentalists, though. So I want to explore with you some of those areas. You have a line, or there's a line in that last volume of the study of fundamentalism called Moral Manichaeanism, which, why don't you explain that?
Okay, Manichaeism goes back to the prophet Mani, a near Middle Eastern, Near Eastern Persian religion that had tremendous influence all over that area and worked its way into some factions of early Christianity. Mani really stood for a kind of a two-god religion. There's a god of light and a god of darkness, and you got to be this or that, to use the words of an old song. So it divides the world very neatly, God versus Satan, Christ versus Antichrist, we versus they. And the president on occasion does that. Now, there's no question about it that when President Reagan or he speaks about evil going on over there, there's evil. But the counterpart to that always is then, therefore, we're the righteous. And again, I like an awful lot of things about us. But once you set it up on that pole, there's no negotiating room. I like it that we have to do business with people we really disagree with. China, when they're billion and our hundreds of millions square off against each other, we are in trouble. We'll be the two biggest economies in 10 years, and there we go. To the degree that we have to do business with each other, we can't fall into that. And one of the problems in the Middle East is you have oil we have to do business with, but the populations don't know that. The publics don't know that. The kids you recruit think they're independent economies. And we think that if we stay in good with Saudi Arabia, then we can let the rest go.
That shoe's going to drop at some point, don't you think?
I think a shoe is going to drop at some point. I think, 20% of all the world's oil reserves are in that one nation. And it's a very divided nation. And generation after generation, as the Saudi princes get to be 20, and then 40, and then 80, and then 160, there's quite a dispersal. And there's a great resentment. The two, if you think of Saudi Arabia as kind of a V shape, the two wings of the V's are where great numbers of people live who aren't cut in on it. And for the nomadic people of the middle country, where the princes are and the oil is, to run it, great resentments. And I think that's why they have to keep the lid on so much. You could say they keep the lid on religious freedom as much as Saddam Hussein ever did. But they're not allowed to bother us, and we entertain them. On one level, I like that because it keeps the conversation open. They got to deal with us. We have to deal with them. But, yes, that shoe can drop, and I have no idea where we go from there.
There's another bit of Bush language that seems to overlap with some of the problems you see in militant fundamentalism, Martin Marty, and that is when he seems to know the outcome of history or the direction of history. In a lot of his speeches, he would talk about he's delivering the gift of freedom. Mm-hmm. It's God's gift to deliver. Or we are marching with history and God is the author of all history. So he lashes the United States to the mast of God. Mm-hmm. Is that troubling to you?
Oh, that's the biggest trouble. I don't really do presidents much. I doubt if I use the current president's name this morning in this program today. I speak about the president, the administration, because I don't like to personalize it, and you can drop it out there, and no one pays attention anymore that you say. But right early on, before the Iraq War, when the National Security paper came out, Newsweek asked me to write about it, and I concentrated on just this theme. Once you've done that, I think you set yourself up all the way back to the biblical prophets. You set yourself up for stuff. And I'm quite a disciple here of Reinhold Niebuhr, who wrote a great little book at the time of the beginning of the Cold War, The Irony of American History. Niebuhr was a Cold Warrior. And so he said all the bad things that one would say about Soviet communism. And then he turned the mirror on us. He's very nice to Jefferson, very nice to Lincoln, but we have slavery. We had what we did to the Native Americans. He had it all there. And he set up a little poll, which he says is the biblical one. America is not a tragic nation. It's not a comic nation. It's not a pathetic nation, but irony. In irony, you set out to do something, and you're too lofty. He liked to quote Psalm 2, verse 4. When the princes of the earth take counsel together, God who sits in the heavens shall laugh. He shall hold them in derision. Because you think you're all that smart and virtuous and innocent and secure, there's just enough ignorance and enough weakness and enough insecurity that you're going to be partly done in. Now, Niebuhr went on, though, there, and I would go on with him, and say, you don't use that kind of thing to say what fools these mortals be. You don't use that to say don't try anything. But rather, you try them in a different way. He said the same God who laughs also holds us responsible and does not dishonor human aspiration. So we have to have foreign policies. We have to have things happening.
But it's a caution against hubris, though.
Hubris, yeah, pride. And really, as you read back to that national security paper and the energies put into it by the Rumsfelds and the Wolfowitzes and the Pearls and so on, they were really, really sure. They didn't all use God language the way the president did, but they were really sure that all the virtue was on our side, all the power is on our side, and we can do what we want, not having learned in Vietnam that you can be the most powerful nation in the world and you can't do everything you want.
There's this combination of unblinking nationalism and right-wing fundamentalism that can be toxic, don't you think?
Yes, it's a strange thing. When fundamentalism was more flexible in America, it wasn't quite that way. Fundamentalism was born in July 1920 as a term and crested early in the Scopes trial, but also the Depression. I've always been interested in the fact if there ever was a socialist scheme in America, it was the Tennessee Valley Authority. It was voted in by fundamentalists, Southern Baptists, Church of Christ, etc. They just wanted their farms lit. They just wanted supports, etc. And at that time, the economy was not on the front. They were very fluid, very flexible. And similarly with the war. Now, when the war came, they were patriotic. Well, who wasn't in World War II? They went along with that and got the rhetoric there. But they simply blended into a larger population. And it's really been the Goldwater campaign. They failed completely while using that language, and many people thought they'd disappear. And they came back in they thought Carter would be their man, and he wasn't. They came back in the Reagan years. Reagan, I think, used them, and they used him. I don't think he ever really was quite one of them. But he said, you can't endorse me, but I can endorse you. So we knew where he stood all the while. But I think at the time of the first Gulf War, we didn't hear as much. It really is the rhetoric this round that is bringing about this identification. I think fundamentalists tend to be ready for the sword more. They love the stories in the Hebrew scriptures of Gideon and David and Goliath and so on.
Why is that?
First of all, they're biblical literalists. I never meet a Jew who thinks that you should kill all the Amalekites and their wives and children, though it's there. All these things are there. But they're literalists, and therefore God the warrior legitimates it. And if you're convinced that you are God's people and they're threatened, you can do whatever you want. Interestingly, though, today there are great numbers of Southern Baptist peace forces and others who are saying, we got to get the main message of the Hebrew scriptures in the end is shalom, the vision of reconciliation, and we better bring that up.
It is interesting how selective some of the people who quote scriptures are. I note that you have described yourself as a short-term pessimist, Martin Marty. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was on a program once with my teacher, Daniel Boorstin, later a librarian of Congress, good historian, quite a conservative person, and Bucky Fuller, who was always living in the 22nd century already, and the Annenbergs had a conference to start a center at the University of Southern California, and we were the three speakers, and they'd been reading Jean Gampel's Decline of the West, a new book on that, and we were supposed to be declinists, and we saw a few good things happening, so we said so. So at halftime, as we said, they called us in and said, you got to be down more. So we came out, and Dan Boorstin said, we do not know enough about the future to be absolutely pessimistic. That's what I mean by short term. The long term, I think the human race, if we don't blow ourselves up now, I think we're beginning to sense the environmental needs. We're beginning to sense some other needs. There are people of peace in every nation we've talked about today. And I think I can't say I'm optimistic. I like to use words associated with my old neighbor. I'm a realistic hoper. You have to be true to the facts, but you can't be done in with cynicism.
And how does that realistic hoper tell us to negotiate or deal with Muslim fundamentalism, right-wing fundamentalism,
By dealing first with Muslims. That is, the more we can not condense it into Islamofascism, the more we can not make it seem as if everybody is that way, the more diversity we see, the more economic, political, humanitarian, and religious grounds we have for connecting is better off. One of the mottos of our fundamentalism project was, these scholars, woo them, don't whomp them. And we're in a whomping mode right now, and we can see what's happening.
Well, I like that motto, woo them, don't womp them. It's been my pleasure, Martin Marty, to have you as my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.